This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. The great state of Wisconsin is home to the only master cheesemaking program outside of Switzerland. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
This week on Meat & Three, we're ringing in the start of our fifth season with dispatches from Portland, Oregon's biggest food festival, Feast Portland. We're bringing you words of wisdom on launching a food business from food blogs.
Most acquaintances from high school have now tried to start a food or fashion blog in some sense and quit very quickly afterwards.
To ice cream shops.
Every city you go to, the salt and straw is completely different than any other city.
We'll bring you insights and anecdotes about the business of the business.
We were like, cool, we're going to do this. We're going to try to raise $75,000 and we'll see what happens. And it was like the most gut-wrenching, miserable month.
Tune in to Meat & Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, hello. Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. We're coming to you live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It is Wednesday, October 2nd, 2019. This is the 228th episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talents in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is a top New Zealand chef, restaurateur, TV personality, and cookbook author. And I will introduce him fully in a moment. First, as I do on every show, I will start with my PR tip, and then later we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to draw inspiration from your surroundings. Yes, take it all in and observe, as the world is a magical place full of wonders. And what makes life even more beautiful is that we all see things a bit differently and can be moved by our own unique experiences. From nature to art to science, technology, and food, inspiration is everywhere. So let's keep our eyes and ears open to see, feel, and connect, and let life naturally enlighten. That's my tip today. Now, this is going to be a fabulous episode. I'm so excited to have my guest here. It is Josh Emmett. He is a critically acclaimed chef and restaurateur from New Zealand who is the co-founder of Go To Collection, which includes Rata, Madam Wu, and Hawker and Roll. And he has a new cookbook, The Recipe, Classic Dishes for the Home Cook from the World's Best Chefs. Josh worked with Gordon Ramsay for over 10 years. During his time at Restaurant Gordon Ramsay, it was awarded 3 Michelin stars, making it the only 3-star restaurant in London. He went on to help open Claridge's, reopen the Savoy, and in 2006, he moved to New York City to oversee Gordon Ramsay at the London New York City, which was awarded 2 Michelin stars. In 2012, he went back to New Zealand and he opened Rata, and he has since opened 6 restaurants across New Zealand, and he's appeared on TV, most known, I think, in New Zealand for being a judge on MasterChef New Zealand. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to have you because, you know, well, first of all, there's so many reasons. You're an amazing chef and restaurateur, and I want to hear your story. But we have the connection of meeting you when you were in New York City and then me visiting Rata back 6 years ago and celebrating my birthday there. And we have this connection and you live on the other side of the world.
Totally. Yeah. I remember vividly when we first met. It was back in 2006 when I just moved to New York from London. And it was back then that was a massive change for me. It was a big life change to come out here, and so I was young and younger and very excited about being in New York.
Yes. Well, I want to go and go back to your background as a child and what inspired you to become a chef, because you grew up, from what I understand, in New Zealand on a farm, right?
Totally.
So how did that influence your career and decision to work in kitchens?
Well, there's a few things. There's my sort of fetish for baking and sweets growing up. So I did a huge amount of baking on the farm. We sort of shopped at supermarkets once a week, and within that, we weren't allowed biscuits or, you know, fizzy drinks or anything like that. But we had the ingredients in the pantry to make as many cakes as you liked, or baked as many cakes as you liked. So, and when you baked a cake, you owned the cake. So I used to do a hell of a lot of baking and a hell of a lot of eating. And then on the farm growing up, I did a lot of fishing. I did a lot of shooting. You know, we're constantly shooting rabbits and duck shooting and fishing for eels, and then out in the sea, fishing in the sea as well. So it's sort of no surprise that when I moved to London and I began, you know, my career cooking and as a chef, that I barely ever took ingredients like eel, duck, game birds, all those sorts of rabbits. I always have those on my menus. And I think it's a result of, you know, growing up with those sorts of ingredients and falling in love with them from a very young age.
Right. So how did you get introduced to Gordon Ramsay? Did you apply for a job? Sorry.
Did I just apply for a job? Yeah, I did. Where had I been? I'd been a couple of years in the UK, and then I came back. I lost my visa, and I went back to Australia and worked really hard for 3 years in Australia. I worked ridiculous hours and worked for a guy called Donovan Cook, who, and his wife Philippa, and they were amazing chefs and great restaurant in Melbourne at that time. And I wanted to get back to the UK, so I got back to the UK, and Donovan sort of knew Gordon, and it was always a bit like that. We always, you know, knew people from within the industry, and I literally walked in and asked for a job, and that's about all I asked for. I asked for a job. I didn't ask about money or, you know, hours or anything. You know, I was just hungry for a job in that kitchen, and it was a funny old time, actually, because, you know, he had just been on that on a show called Britain's Worst Bosses, and, you know, it was supposedly one of the worst places to work in the UK, and I loved every moment of it.
Well, you have a big smile on your face saying this, but yeah, and he's known in the US for his show in Hell's Kitchen, and just his personality, from what I know on TV, or his TV personality, is very different than what I know about your personality. I don't know if, you know, I guess... I mean, you worked with him for a long time. So what was that experience like? And did you have full reign, like when you were here in New York with the London? Was that, I don't know, did you have to report to him on things, or was it more left to your decision making on the menu?
Well, yeah, all of that. I mean, I was back then. That was 2000 when I first started with him, and I was, you know, 26 and. Extremely driven and extremely ambitious, and food, it still is. Food is everything to me. Restaurants are everything to me. I love my career and always have. And, you know, I think one thing that Gordon always gave me was an amazing platform on which to perform. And, you know, he sort of said that, you know, I'll set you up and, you know, put you in a place, and you've just got to put the hard work in and go and do it, you know. And he actually gave you autonomy, and I always wanted to treat those restaurants, you know, even though they were Gordon's, like my own. I took complete ownership of them, and that's one thing I probably did particularly well, you know. I just owned it. I went in there and I treated it like it was my little baby, and away I went. And you know, I suppose that was the case when I came out to New York. You know, Gordon can't be anywhere, like, you know, he had up to 15, 16, 17 restaurants at the time. I mean, you can't be everywhere, can you? And you rely on great staff to do that. And I was a very loyal subject, and, you know, I was with him 11 years and had great experiences.
Yeah, so what prompted you then to move back to New Zealand and start on your own?
Well, I moved to Australia, actually. New York was good back then, but we were dealing with unions and lots of issues. And we had two Michelin stars, and it was an amazing experience. But I think we had had our first child, Helen and I, and we met in New York, and we decided to go and open Gordon's project in Australia, and then we were going to go back to the UK. But there's a whole long story around this period. You know, my dad randomly got cancer at that period. And was, only given a year to live. We had a second child, the career wasn't really progressing in the areas that I wanted it to. So we sort of actually ended up moving back to New Zealand and finishing up with Gordon right at the time that my dad only had a couple of months to live, which was a real blessing because I got to spend the last few months with him. And then we went back to the UK for 18 months. And while we were in the UK, I started doing MasterChef in New Zealand, and I also opened Rata in New Zealand. So for the first year of Rata, I was commuting between London and Queenstown, and we had two young kids.
Oh, wow.
Those were interesting times, but Rata, was an amazing project and something that I always wanted to do. And most people expected me to go back to New Zealand and, open something in Auckland I was pursuing both ideas in London and in New Zealand. But Queenstown was a little place you've been there that really sort of stole my heart, I guess. The question, how did I end up back in New Zealand? I don't know. It just happened.
It happened.
I was probably least likely to end up of my, siblings to end up back in New Zealand. And I got to a point where I was doing more work in New Zealand and it just made complete sense to be there. And I was fed up with traveling between London and New Zealand.
Yeah, and Queenstown has a place in my heart too. I loved being there. And I also went to Auckland, which is a fabulous city as well. I mean, I picked one in the north and one in the south with my limited time. And I think at the time when you were there, you were doing the commute back and forth to Auckland, which I didn't know you had done that with London previously. So I guess that was easier.
Totally.
But since then, you've now gone on to open these Malaysian restaurant concepts. So what inspired that and doing that sort of cuisine?
A couple of things. I've always lived in Auckland, so I've been traveling to and from Queenstown twice a month for 7 years.
Miles.
And counting. It's only a 2-hour flight, so it's not too bad. The Malaysian concept, I've always had a love for Malaysian food. I had a girl who was working for me in Australia, a Malaysian girl, and she came down and started working for us at Rata in Queenstown. My business partner and I were looking for sort of a second concept after Rata, and we started pursuing the Malaysian idea, and then a site sort of got presented to us that just completely fit with the idea of doing a Malaysian restaurant, and we'd already been doing menu testers and various other things like that, so away we went. We sort of opened it within 6 weeks, and we always wanted Madame Wu, which is called to. The idea was to have more than one. So it was very much designed from a concept point of view that it was casual and quick and very traditional Malaysian food, but in a really upmarket environment, funky environment, noisy and bustling. And the whole thing just clicked. It went crazy right from the start. It was just one of those things that everything aligned and it happened and away we went. And we opened three more after that and then continued on with Hawker and Roll, which is a... When I opened Madame Wu, I created a dish called the Hawker Roll, which is basically a way of eating Malaysian food. It's roti canai with either beef rendang or percik chicken or various other things inside the roti. And then, pickles and cucumber and coriander and sambal and all this sort of thing.
Making me very hungry.
Oh, my God. They're amazing things. So that sort of spurned the concept of Hawker and Roll, which we've got four of those in New Zealand as well.
So are you looking to develop more of these? And are you only, if so, are you only looking to do these New Zealand, maybe Australia or on down under, or are you thinking maybe you'd expand beyond that region?
Yeah, well, my business partner and I, we've traveled a lot, and we went up to, you know, the UK, and we went to San Francisco, and went to Brisbane, and we, you know, went to Sydney and Melbourne, and all over the place, and constantly sort of looking. But, you know, right now I think we're focused on New Zealand because, you know, the flying's not that easy.
it's far.
The romantic idea of opening restaurants all over the world, in theory, I'd love to do it. But I've spent far too much of my life, I think, personally, flying all over the world. From New Zealand, you have to fly, 10 hours to get up to LA and 26, 28 hours to get to London. And, everywhere is a long way away. So, and it would mean a lifestyle change, I think. I would be happy to possibly leave New Zealand and go and do that, but that would be the decision I would have to make, if I did want to go outside of New Zealand. So we're very much focused in New Zealand.
Okay, so I have to get back. But so far, I know, but I have to get back. And before we take a break, what about these TV appearances you do and being a judge? Are you doing shows right now?
Yeah, MasterChef New Zealand's finished for now. I did five seasons, five incredible seasons of it. Actually, I absolutely loved it, it's extremely hard work for those. We filmed for generally 3 months of the year, it was 17, 18 episodes, and it just meant that, you do a 4 day work week on top of your already a 5 day work week, and you work 7 days a week for 3 months, and it's extremely tough but hugely enjoyable, and I wouldn't change anything. And I really enjoy presenting on TV. I think it's something that was slightly out of my comfort zone, and something that I wanted, like anything, you sort of just want to be good at it. You want to do well, right? And
yeah.
So it's something that I had to work at quite hard, and probably more than anything is work to stay relaxed, because staying relaxed in that environment isn't always that easy, right? And generally when you're relaxed, you're at your best, so.
Right, well, I would think maybe being a judge versus being someone who's competing would be a little more relaxing, but I don't know, it's still TV.
No, you're right. It is far more relaxing. And I'm forgetting the most important part. The most important part was really the people we met along mm-hmm. the way, and the food we ate, just glorious. You can see my face light up when I start talking about food in any respect, right? And some of the dishes we ate and were introduced to on that show were just mind-blowing, from all sorts of people, from all sorts of walks of life, non-professional cooks. So much fun.
So much fun.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, let's take a little break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to talk with Josh about his new book that's out. So stay with us. This is On the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that 90% of Wisconsin's milk is made into cheese? And this is not just any milk. When Swiss, German, and Italian cheesemakers first settled into Wisconsin, they chose their new home because of the special terroir of the region. Its soil and water are nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment, and those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin produces 25% of all cheeses made in the U.S., and Wisconsin cheeses have won more awards than any other state or country in the world. How did they do it? Wisconsin cheesemakers combined their heritage and tradition with nonstop innovation. They were the first state to establish cheese grade standards and the first to require that every cheese plant be overseen by a licensed cheesemaker. Wisconsin is the only place outside of Europe where one can pursue an elite master cheesemaker certification. All of these impeccably high standards mean Wisconsin produces more than 48% of the nation's specialty cheese.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest is Josh Emmett. He's a New Zealand chef and the co-founder of Go-To Collection, which includes Rata, Madam Wu, and Hawker and Roll. And he has a new book out called The Recipe, a modern-day food Bible. It's awesome, by the way, this food Bible that we have here. So let's talk about this, and it's quite a book. I mean, you have over 300 recipes in this?
Yeah, I do. Thank you. Yeah.
So how did you come up with the idea for it and go about the collection of recipes and chefs that are featured?
Yeah, I've written a couple of... This is my third book, for this book, I was wanting to do something different, and I was really wanting to do something that I could, do on an international platform, I guess. And we came up with the idea of the ridiculous idea, I think, of doing a collaborative book where we, you know, worked with... we took the 50 years and the 300 greatest classic recipes and put them all in one book. And the recipes that you must cook once in your lifetime, if you're a foodie or if you love food, and wanted to put them all inside one sort of food Bible. And it was... And have the contributions from chefs around the world. And we sort of came up with a list of recipes, which was well over 300 or 400 of what we considered really great classic recipes, and then sort of paired them with chefs and then went about this massive task of going out to the chefs and asking if they would love to contribute to the book and have their recipe, and generally they are, it's in their area of expertise. So it is about having the Bible and the best possible recipe of that particular dish right. in this book.
How long did you work on this project? Because I know working with chefs or getting recipes from chefs can be, challenging. A process. And then recipe testing wise, did you do it on your own or did you collaborate with the chef on it? I mean, that had to have been a challenging project working with so many different people.
It was an incredible, I have to say it was an incredibly tough process. Everything. There was nothing easy about this book. And I think going into it, it's one of those projects, if you really knew how hard it was going to be, you would just be like, oh no, that's too hard. We're not going to do that. But it has been so rewarding as well. So we went out to the chefs. The process is that they, send us the recipe with or without a picture. Often we ask for a picture as reference. And then I shot them in my home, shot and tested them in my home, and, then send them back for approval. So getting the recipes getting the chefs on board was the first part of the process. And that was... months, 6, 8, 9, 10 months, almost a year of, asking chefs and slowly getting the recipes through. And that was an emotional roller coaster, right? That was my first part of my project. And, you live on different time zones in New Zealand. So you wake up in the morning, you get a yes from someone and you'd be like, oh my God, I can't believe they said yes. Yeah. Because the list we went out with was, sort of the who's who in the culinary world. There's some incredible people that I have so much respect, or I've got so much respect for chefs in general anyway. And I get on with almost everyone. So, but there's people in there. I'm so humbled to have them in the book. And then, the days when we didn't get some people in the book, it's just one of those things. You're going out and asking, you're putting yourself on the line a little bit. Then the process actually of turning around and cooking their recipes. And that's sort of when I woke up one morning and went, oh God, what have I done? This book can't just be a straightforward. It can't be good. It has to be exceptional. I have to cook these recipes and photograph these recipes and send them back to approval. And I was under, to be honest, I was under a ridiculous amount of pressure. I put myself under a lot of pressure for a long year of shooting these recipes.
Well, you mastered it. I mean, the book is beautiful. You also have gorgeous photos with it. And I mean, some of the people, I jotted down some of the names. You have Daniel Ballou, Daniel Hulm. I saw you had Nobu, you had the black cod miso in there, and I was thinking, I love that dish. I should try to cook it.
Oh, totally.
Go ahead.
I mean, when Nobu says yes, you know, and he's going to come in your book, and you know, friends of mine, you know, whether it's Marcus Glocker or, you know, Ron Paprocki, who cooks in New York here, yeah, or David Chang, or, you know, so many people who agreed to participate. Daniel Hamm early on said, you know, he was too busy. And we funnily enough, we just sat on that for a year. And then we went back to him and said, would you reconsider? And he said yes. So, you know, extremely ecstatic about that. But, yeah, it's a tough process going through that end, but it's hugely enjoyable. I learned so much.
I'm sure. Because, well, having to be the one that tested all those recipes, your go-to dishes now, you have 300 plus.
Yeah.
Everything else you've been cooking your entire career.
No, and there's a few things about the book that they have to be, the recipes had to be really simple, true classics, and really simple and accessible for the home cook. Now, there is some more aspirational dishes in there, but a lot of them are very, very simple dishes and ideas, everything from mashed potato to scrambled eggs to beef Wellington to ramen to, you know, all those sorts of things. And then what we did with the book, and what Kieran Scott, who shot the book, is such a genius at, we shot a few sort of test images, and we've got 150 personalities, and we all know that chefs' personalities are strong at the best of times, you know. So we sort of had to take all the personality out of the book. So we shot it all on a white or black background and all on a white or black plate. So it completely restricted and took every, you know, it's the book is all about the food, and the photography is all about the dish, and it sort of shows a complete respect for that, and you can see that makes it more of a Bible and more of a manual than a book about anything other than the dish, which is I think the thing that we got so right, and Kieran's, you know, such a genius in that respect, because he just gets that. You know, he drove a lot of that direction with me. I mean, we've spent a lot of time hanging out as well, so.
I'm sure. And actually, from following you on social media, you test a lot of recipes in your kitchen, or you cook, you know, you show a lot of this behind the scenes of cooking, which I think, and with your kids, I think it's very cool.
Yeah, totally. So we, you know, the platform that we mostly use is Instagram, leading up to the book, we decided that we'd really focus on, social media and Instagram as a way to promote the book. And we also are trying to answer that age-old question, and the question I get asked constantly, which is like, oh, my God, you must eat like kings at home. And what do you eat on a nightly basis? And who cooks? I literally get asked that the whole time, as do probably most chefs. And the answer is that we struggle like everyone, you know, we don't know what to cook, you know, from one night to the next, and then we're going out, and then you go out another night and you miss two nights, and, you know, you don't use what's in your fridge, and it's difficult, right? And I'm a good cook, right? I'm handy in the kitchen.
Yes.
And so is my wife. So what we sort of are going out and trying to answer that question and help people with that. So we shoot literally everything that we eat at home. We just shoot it as we cook it, and we post it, and it seems that it really resonates with people, and people really can follow what we're doing, simply because it's not staged in any way. It's just me cooking at home. And people send in the dishes that they've cooked and replicated, and that's brilliant.
It is. I have to say, though, I know you're just cooking at home, but it still looks very professional to me, because your knife skills, you're bringing your skill set into your own kitchen. But it's been, I think it's been a smart move on your part, and for promoting this book, and just also exposing to people what it is like to be a chef and have kids and cook at home, you know?
totally. It's been and we've got a great following of people who love to watch the recipes and cook them, which is perfect. And we do cook quite a few out of the book, some of my favorite ones out of the book. I mean, we did the chicken pot pie, which is in the book, which is from a guy called Bruce Poole, who's, you know, I met years ago when I was in London. He's an amazing chef, been at Chez Bruce for for so many years, and the chicken pot pie just, you know, people love it, right? It's a
comfort food.
It's a sensational recipe. Exactly, comfort food.
Awesome. Let's go to my question for my last guest, who I asked to ask you something. So this is on episode 227. I had on Regina Varoli. She's a journalist and the founder and editor-in-chief of Cult Epi, which is a culinary industry platform for people in the industry. So let's play back her question for you.
I wanted to ask him about sustainability. I know New Zealand has a lot of good policies about sustainability as far as farming or fishing or not using pesticides. And his restaurant, you know, makes a point of trying to be a sustainable restaurant. So I would like to know from him, Josh, what do you think is something that you could export to the U.S. from New Zealand as far as ideas for what restaurants can do to be more sustainable since we are all facing a climate crisis?
True.
True.
That's a big question.
It is a big question.
You know, there is so much we want to do and I think try to do through our restaurant. If we can just specifically talk about Rata, which is in Queenstown, you know, we cook extremely seasonally in Rata because of proximity. And, you know, we're very careful with our use of plastics. You know, straws went years ago, as they probably did in hopefully most of the US. You know, plastic straws, that sort of thing.
They're starting to go here, but I think we're a little behind.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And New Zealand is, well, then New Zealand would be quite advanced in that respect, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We try and use as sustainable fisheries as possible. You know, New Zealand is small, so it has its own set of problems, I think. But, you know, freight is difficult in New Zealand. You know, carting things around New Zealand is very costly. So in Rata in Queenstown, which is down the bottom of the South Island, you know, we're really focused on using as local as possible from a cost perspective and from a business value sense as well. You know, there's a new thing in New Zealand that I'm starting to use a lot more of, which is beeswax paper. And, you know, it's great for wrapping things like cheese, but you can literally wrap anything and everything in it. You know, instead of use of plastics or anything like that. And then, our food waste goes to, local farms for pigs or whatever else. So you separate out your waste and, you know, that costs a little bit more, but those are business decisions you make because those are your values, I guess. As I say, New Zealand is a small country, so certain things are easier, but I still think we've got a hell of a lot of work to do and a lot of thinking and a lot of cost management to get it right.
Yeah, well, it's a great answer to a great question, so thank you. We're going to take another break here, and we're going to come back, and we'll have my speed round game, and we will talk some industry news. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. Hi, my name is Sam Benrubi, and I'm the host of The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. With this show, we bring wine to the people. Each week, we bring the best guests in wine on, taste different wines on air, and invite our listeners to taste with us. You'll find our approach to wine decidedly unsnobby. You can find The Grape Nation wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Josh Emmett. It's time for my speed round game. What this is I name a couple things and you get to pick your preference, such as chocolate or vanilla. Are you ready? Vanilla.
That was easy. That was the first one.
Good, good. You got the test one. Well done. So yeah. I think you're ready.
I'm ready.
Okay. Here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Eat out.
Wine, beer, cocktail, or mocktail?
Wine.
Tasting menu or a la carte?
A la carte.
Small plates or large plates?
Large plates.
Communal table or chef's counter?
Communal table.
Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
It's a tough one. All-inclusive.
Okay. Fine dining or hawker food halls?
Hawker food halls.
Inspiration there, right?
Yeah.
How about testing classic recipes or creating new ones?
Testing classic recipes.
Ah, interesting. Okay, two more. Cheese plate or dessert?
Dessert.
Manhattan, Brooklyn, Auckland, Queenstown, anywhere else in New Zealand?
Exactly. Auckland.
Ah, Auckland.
Loving Auckland right now.
Fabulous. I Auckland, I knew nothing about it before I visited, but it is quite an amazing city.
It's a really nice place, you know. Now listen, I'm in New York right now, and I adore New York. You know, why wouldn't you? You know, I adore London as well, but for me right now, I think I'm really enjoying Auckland.
Cool. Well, own it.
Exactly.
Awesome. That's the game. So for industry news, there was an article yesterday that came out in the New York Times, and it's entitled, "Want to Write a Cookbook? Don't Count the Money Just Yet." And this was by Priya Krishna. And I just saw the title and read through the article, and I was like, this would be great to write, to talk about with you, considering you have a new book out and you've done more than one. So, I mean, this was a very honest article talking about sort of the reality of writing cookbooks and how a lot of writers don't get offered much pay, and that it's hard, you know, and it's a commitment. And so what's your take on this, or just in general about writing cookbooks?
Writing cookbooks, you know, from my perspective, I write cookbooks, and I've written three cookbooks because I have a want and need to scratch that itch, and I have a repertoire of recipes in my head. You know, the first two cookbooks I wrote because the recipes are in my head and it was easy. The third cookbook, with contributing chefs with their recipes, was a harder process, but it was brilliant. You know, and I learnt so much, and that got me back into reading cookbooks again, which I should do so much more of. The money from cookbooks, you know, I don't know. The simple answer to that is do it because you love it, not because you're wanting a revenue stream from it.
Yeah. Well, and I've always thought of or known that, you know, you do a book or mostly because of the love, or maybe the PR and the marketing that you'll get from it, but it's not going to be the money maker for you. But maybe a lot of chefs or people want to do a book because it gets your name out there more, and it exposes your recipes, and exposes, like, just gives you marketing. But it seems now, I mean, chefs are just doing books left and right. It's become a very popular thing, I think, more so now in the past 5 years than it was 10, 15 years ago.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's sort of expected in some ways that if you're a chef and you've got restaurants, that you'll do a cookbook. You know, you could do one to, as I say, that you would promote your restaurant. Or you know, just yourself. But I think you do need to do them because of a love of food, or because you like to write, and you want to, you know, have that down on paper, I suppose. You know, as a history of your journey through food. I think I sometimes see it in that sort of, I'm not romantic about many things, but I definitely...
Yeah.
Think that it shows a journey from me anyway.
Yeah. Did you work with a writer, a ghostwriter, or anyone on your books, or did you do it all?
No, the first two I did completely myself, and actually the third one I did pretty much all myself as well, you know, writing. And we had funny conversations about that because I was stressed out and doing those things. And my wife, Helen, she at one stage, isn't someone else supposed to be doing that? Why are you doing that? And I said, I actually don't know the answer to that. I'm doing it because I think I have to do it. And I wrote, you know, pretty much everything. And I actually enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think it's a time issue maybe sometimes for chefs or not being comfortable as writers. I mean, that's another thing nowadays chefs. It's like you used to be a chef or a cook and you're in the kitchen and you cook food. And now there's so much pressure or responsibility in a sense to be more, you know, to write cookbooks or to be on social media. And so, and not everyone who maybe wants to have a cookbook can do all that. And so there are fabulous people out there, ghostwriters, and who assist chefs.
Totally. And I think actually these days that you don't have to be a chef to do a cookbook. Any, you know, schools do cookbooks as fundraisers. You know, people who love food just do cookbooks. Cookbooks aren't an easy process, and then I don't think they're ever going to be. You know, writing a book isn't straightforward. It can be an extremely enjoyable process. I'm not saying I'm just saying that they're not straightforward.
Right.
There's a huge amount of work that go into them, right? And a huge amount of everything from the design to the, you know, the text and the fonts and the size and the shape and the weight of the paper. I mean, there is so much to consider. It's not, you know, that you can easily flip through a book and not consider all that. Just think that sort of happens. So it's, you know, it's not something I would take on lightly, ever.
Yeah, so that's, I'm thinking, will there be another book in your future or is it too early to say?
No.
You would do another one?
I would. I need a rest from this one. But I definitely have another one. It's one of those things where you go, anything that's painful in life, you often forget, you know, and then you come back and you're like, oh, I want to do that again.
Right. Well,
even though the journey was a difficult one with that book, I think, you know, you can see it in the end result that you get an outstanding end result because you really put the effort in to make sure it was where you stuck to your values the whole way along and really didn't bend the rules at any point.
Yeah, and that just made me think also you have this book now that's not, it's here, it's to stay. It's like not going anywhere. It's like a permanent thing versus a restaurant or food that goes out and gets eaten and then is gone. Like this is a collection of all the recipes. It's like, you know, it's a good, you know, you can hold it forever.
This is an important book to me because it's a record of, you know, in some ways of some of the greatest dishes of the last almost 100 years, right? There's dishes in there that have been around for a long time and stood the test of time and are just brilliant. And the recipes are, you know, from chefs who are exceptional in their field and have excelled in the industry. So there's some recipes that have been handed down, some family recipes, you know, whether it's a duck cassoulet recipe that's in there from Pascal in London, you know, a French guy. And, you know, there's things like that.
Right.
That's just gold. Those are the recipes that you hunt out and often people don't give you. Right?
Well,
those are the ones you want.
You managed to get them, so. great. We're going to take one more break. Before we do, I have a couple announcements about upcoming events. So, first, New York City Wine and Food Festival is coming up on October 13th through 19th in New York City. And this is the 12th annual festival. It's sponsored by the Food Network and Cooking Channel and presented by Capital One. It's one of New York's most versatile culinary extravaganzas, and it returns to Eat, Drink, and End Hunger, benefiting Food Bank for New York City and No Kid Hungry. And there's tickets still available. There's some new events like Elvis Duran's Taste of New York. Returning again is the Blue Moon Burger Bash presented by Pat LaFrieda. And Pat has been on my show, and also I have to mention founder Lee Schrager was on my show back in episode 20, which seems like well, it was a long time ago, but this festival has been going strong. So if you want to get tickets, you can go to nycwff.org. The other thing coming up, Star Chefs ICC, and this is the 14th annual Star Chefs International Chefs Congress, and it's taking place October 27th to 29th at the Brooklyn Expo Center in Brooklyn. The theme is New Foundations, Flavor Plus Technique Plus Business, and this they have main stage demonstrations, hands-on workshops, business panels, competitions, and Congress Eats. It's an amazing lineup. And there's a working pass, industry pass, and also vendor supplier passes. So there's lots of options of attending. And their website, starchefs.com. And I'm planning to go to both of these for part of the time because they both take place over a couple of days, and they're always great. So I hope to see you there. Okay, we're going to take one more break. We'll come back. We'll do my solo dining experience and have the final question. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. It's time for my solo dining experience. This week, it's at Aleppo Suites. Here's the rundown. The location, 107 Ives Street, Providence, Rhode Island. The concept, authentic Syrian bakery and cafe. The chef and owner, Yosef Akhtarini. So why did I go? So I was en route to Newport Mansion's Wine and Food Festival, and Providence was sort of along the way from the airport. I did fly into Providence. So, and I had read about this place recently. It was on Bon Appetit's Hot 50 restaurant list by Julia Kramer and had a nice write-up by Priya Krishna. And they talked about their house-made baklava, and I was sold, so I decided to go. So my experience. So straight from the airport in the morning, I Ubered over to this place. I got there right when they opened at 10 a.m. because I had an early morning flight. I went in with my suitcase, rolled it all in, and went to the counter, decided what to get, and then they deliver your food and drinks to your table. I also had my laptop with me, so I ended up doing some work while I had my meal. So what did I get? So they have all different types of baklava, and there were 8 that day, and they actually have a box of 8, so I tried them all, and I also had I had a Turkish coffee, and I was there for a bit, so then I had a pot of ginger cardamom mint tea, and that was served in a really pretty copper pot, and some of the selection of baklava I had a classic with chopped walnuts, I had lady fingers with crushed pistachio, there was a chocolate and a vegan one. So my take, it was delicious. I mean, all the baklavas were really great. Probably my favorite was there was a chocolate pistachio one. The coffee was really good, strong, but I have to say this tea was probably one of the best teas I've ever had. I drank the whole pot. So the ambiance, it's a very welcoming space. It has a kind of warm intimacy about it. And as I said, you order at a counter up front, and then you can sit. It's a squared dining room with banquette seats, and it's cozy. And the baklavas are on display up front too, so you can pick and choose what you want. I'd say it's perfect for dessert lovers. Interesting tidbit, baklava is included in my guest Josh Emmett's book, The Recipe. I found it on page 326, and it's a recipe by Claudia Rodin, who's a British cookbook writer. So you can test that out. Personal fun fact, so after breakfast, I went to Newport, and I was there for Newport Mansions Wine and Food Festival. My client, Opie Crooks of Rakes Progress, was participating, and it was just a lovely weekend, beautiful weather, and all of their events take place at these mansions, and so it's quite stunning. So the cost of my meal at Aleppo Suites was $22, not including tax and gratuity. Would I go back? Yes, I would. I'd like to actually try their lunch and have more than just the suites, which also looked really good. Their website is aleppo-suites.com. So there you go. You make baklava a lot at home?
Well, let me tell you about that baklava. And I met Claudia in London because I hadn't met her before. And I met her in London when I was there a couple of months ago. And she came to an event that I hosted. She was amazing. The baklava, we had to clear out of the house. It was one of those things you just literally could not stop eating. And so we donated it around the corner where there was three young boys who could just destroy it and it not affect their livelihood, like me, who keep just picking and picking and picking. Amazing recipe. Brilliant recipe.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, is it difficult to make?
It's time consuming, but it's not difficult. It's not difficult. It's just a layering process. So you layer upon layer upon layer and, you know, very sweet, but it's very satisfying. But oh my God, delicious. So delicious. Those are the things that I crave. Right. So that's what I say. Get it out of the house before you eat the whole thing.
Very good. Good to know. Okay, it's time for the final question. So my next guests are executive chef Michael Anthony and pastry chef Miro Uskokovic of Gramercy Tavern, which is a contemporary seasonal American restaurant in New York City. It's part of Union Square Hospitality Group, and this year they've been celebrating their 25th anniversary. So, Josh, what would you like to ask Michael and Moreau?
Well, firstly, 25 years, congratulations. Big fan, and I've loved the restaurant for so many years. Question is, I guess, and pretty apt, the fact that they're 25 years old. Gramercy Tavern has an identity of its own. How do you manage, I guess, change, and does it become status quo, or does it become maintaining a certain standard? You know, when you've got staff at front of house and back of house that are coming in, and they either come to work because it's Gramercy Tavern, or they come with ideas. How do you manage those ideas whilst staying true to what Gramercy Tavern is? Because Gramercy Tavern possibly shouldn't change. I don't know. That's the question.
That's a good question. You know, I get asked a lot, what's your favorite restaurant? And I can't ever answer it. But if I had to start naming favorites in New York or places I would go back to again and again, Gramercy Tavern would be on my list. It's just, you can never go wrong from revisiting. And the fact that it has been here for sustaining that for 25 years is so impressive.
Totally. It says a lot about the business.
Yeah, it really does. I'm excited to have them on. So that's the show.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for flying in from Auckland, coming out to Bushwick, joining me, and congratulations to you for your entire career, your new book. And I love having the connection with you, and I have to try to figure out when I'm going to get back down under.
Great. We'll look forward to seeing you in Auckland sometime then.
Yes. I have a friend in Auckland. So thank you so much, and congratulations.
Pleasure.
My guest today has been Josh Emmett. He is New Zealand chef and the co-founder of GoTo Collection, which includes Rata, Madam Wu, and Hawker and Roll. His new book is The Recipe, which you can find, I know it's on Amazon.com, and your website's gotocollection.co.nz, and social media at Josh Emmett.
Yep.
Am I missing anything?
Nah, Instagram, go for it.
Go for it. Follow him. And follow me. I'm at Sherry Bayer at Bayer PR at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. Website's BayerPublicRelations.com, SherryBayer.com, and AllInTheIndustry.com. All of our shows are archived at heritageradionetwork.org. We are also on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks to my engineer today, Jeet, and thanks again to Josh. I'm Sherry Bayer. I will be back next week with another live show. Hope you'll tune in then. And thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye. All in the Industry is powered by Simplecast. I'm Sherry Bayer, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.